expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.
Welcome to the second week of the Winter Pledge Drive and an Access Hour clip show. When scheduling changes happen last minute, sometimes we have to get a little creative here on the Access Hour. And I can't think of a better way to highlight how unique and important a show like the Access Hour is than by sharing clips from various shows over the years. But first, we need to remind you to please call in to pledge, and that number is 608-256-2001, extension 1, or you can go online at WRTFM.org and click on the orange banner at the top of the page to donate. And the Access Hour does have a slightly high goal tonight, so they have been they're putting their trust in us that this little show can bring in some more cash than it normally does, so we definitely need your help this week. But let's start out as to why anybody listens to WORT in general. I know that I started listening to WORT because I was looking for coverage of local elections. This was probably, 2018 into 2019, trying to figure out like who my local government candidates were. I wanted to get more into my community and know who I was voting for. And the WORT local news that we just got finished listening to had some incredible coverage that I just couldn't find on the internet. And from there, I started listening to other shows like Rockin' John on Saturdays or Something Wonderful, which is actually on after the Access Hour tonight. But I want to also ask my engineer, the Access Hour engineer, Emmett, why'd you start listening to WORT?
It was music, Adrian. Music for me. I mean, there are so many great shows on WORT. Green Morning Radio, Mud Acres, Back to the Country, Tropical Rhythms. And I like all the times that WORT will take new artists and give them a live spot on the radio to show us what they can do.
Yeah, and local artists, too. And that was a big push that when I started being a volunteer on the Access Hour, I really wanted us to give more airtime to local artists. And now I like to think that that is pretty well known now, that if you have a band and you're looking to perform live on the radio, that you can sign up to host an Access Hour and talk all about your local music and perform. But this is a pledge drive, and we do have thank you gifts. So we should talk a little bit about that and hopefully get you calling in. And that number again is 608-256-2001, extension 1. Ken is in the lobby. He is answering phones tonight. And Ken also used to be the producer and engineer on the Access Hour. So we do kind of keep it in the family here. But one thing you can get this time around as a thank you gift is the knitted cap. So that is a black ribbed knit cap with a wide cuff, and embroidered on the front is the WORT logo. And that is the same logo that you would find on the WORT embroidered patch. And the hat is at the $75 level. Emmett, what else can they get?
Well, if you want to kick it up a little bit to the, I think it's the $120 level, you can get the new WORT hoodie, Another Weirdo for WORT. It's a very nice hooded sweatshirt, has a roomy hood, spandex waist, spacious center pouch pocket, and comes in a choice of four different colors, cardinal red, charcoal briquette, denim, or olive. And there's some notes on here about the sizes, so make sure you go to our webpage, WORTFM.org, and get specifics on how to order the size sweatshirt you want, because we want you to get the one that fits you.
Definitely. And also, Ken has that information. So if you call in, he can definitely walk you through that as well. Don't forget, You can pledge online at wrtfm.org. And going in, oh, do we have a last minute pledge from the local news? Hold on a second here.
Yes, we do. We'd like to say a very big thank you very much to Michael Fronti, who called in 608-256-2001 and made a very generous donation to local news. So thank you very much. So be like Michael Fronti. Give us a call at 608-256-2001 and make a big pledge to WORT. Big or small, and it doesn't, the size doesn't matter. 10 cents, 50 cents, $1.50, $1.35. I don't mind. Just something.
Everything helps. Anything helps. Everything helps. Thank you so much. All right. So we're going to get into the first clip tonight on the Access Hour Clip Show. And this originally aired on July 12th of 2021. So if you remember back, that's when we were still very much in the pandemic and hardly anyone was allowed in the WRT studios. It was also just a month since I had starred as my current position as WRT's volunteer and outreach coordinator. I chose this clip because it shows the Access Hour can give a platform to all sorts of nonprofit organizations around Wisconsin. Did you know that there are local monkey sanctuaries around Wisconsin that house retired monkeys from UW-Madison? Primates Incorporated is located in Marquette County, just outside of Westfield, Wisconsin, on 17 acres. The hosts were Erica Fleury, Program Director of the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance, and Amy Kerwin, founder of Primates Incorporated, who shared everything you need to know about monkey sanctuaries.
Hello, and welcome to the WORT Access Hour. We're going to be talking to you about lots of monkey business, so let's jump right in. My name is Erica Fleury. I'm the Program Director of the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance, which is a coalition of 10 of the leading primate sanctuaries in North America that care for over 800 rescued and retired primates, like apes and monkeys. So I'm located in Los Angeles. I'm also the author of a book called Monkey Business and a forthcoming book called The Founders. And so since 2014, I've been leading this alliance, which we refer to as NAPSA, because that's a lot easier to say than North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance. NAPSA's mission is to unite the primate sanctuary community, build capacity to provide sanctuary for captive non-human primates, and advocate to eliminate primate exploitation. There are so many hot topics related to the exploitation and then care of captive primates. So we have a lot to talk about today with you. NAPSA's work focuses mainly on using our collective voice for advocacy work. So that includes public education, like this radio show, and also helping to end exploitive practices involving primates. Also, we love to support progress for primates, like laws that prohibit primate ownership or even limit it. So we'll get into that a little bit later. Currently, NAPSA is leading a campaign called Chimpanzees in Need that is focused on raising funds to rescue and rehome chimpanzees left at a California wildlife refuge that unexpectedly shut in 2019. There were 42 chimpanzees there at the time, and we have rehomed many of them, but there are still 26 in need of help. And so NAPSA hopes that one day it will not be necessary to be caring for primates and rescuing them in this way, because primate sanctuaries will hopefully no longer be needed to house captive primates. Maybe one day they'll no longer need to be rescued. They'll no longer need salvation. Because they will no longer be used in these industries that we're going to talk to you about right now. So one of our newest member sanctuaries is Primates Incorporated in Wisconsin. They're a monkey sanctuary that first joined NAPSA in 2016. Now, I first met its founder, Amy Kerwin, in 2014. We were at a NAPSA workshop, like a conference, in San Antonio, Texas. And we were both newer to the sanctuary world, but Amy had certainly been around longer than I had, and she was smack in the middle of researching everything that she possibly could about how to start a new monkey sanctuary. To her credit, she knew this was no small feat. She knew it was not going to be easy, and that there was a lot to learn from those that had already paved the path before her. So So I think now is a great time for Amy to introduce herself and talk about her important work.
Well, thank you, Erica. It's good to talk to you again. And thank you, WORT, for having us. It's exciting to speak to you all about Primates Incorporated. I actually formed the organization in 2004 while I was working in a laboratory with 97 rhesus monkeys. And I thought the least we could do is give back to them and send the monkeys to a sanctuary whenever possible. I mean, especially if we were getting funding to test on the monkeys because they were so similar to us, then the least we could do is improve their welfare through positive reinforcement training and socialization and retiring them to sanctuaries. But at that time, my laboratory management was against retiring them. However, I learned that other laboratories were retiring monkeys, and then they were contacting the existing sanctuaries who are doing great work, and it takes so much time and effort and resources to help monkeys that I was hearing stories of these existing sanctuaries who were actually turning away researchers wanting to retire their monkeys. And so I knew that the need existed to help them. And I wanted to learn about primates, and that's why I started working at the primate lab in college. And then after year five, I decided to leave my 97 rhesus friends and the friends I knew at the primate lab, who also grew close to the monkeys. But I decided that I needed to work with the labs who are retiring the monkeys, since thousands of them need help. And then pave the path to help inspire more communities to create monkey sanctuaries, since thousands are used across the U.S. And basically, we had to define the need to help these monkeys, because when you have the local laboratory culture being against primate retirement while you're trying to promote a cause that there's such a need for a primate sanctuary, you can imagine that there's all these barriers. And so I had to tell the public and be in the public eye and make a case for this by telling them exactly what I just mentioned, that, you know, existing laboratories are getting turned away. And so if we set up in Wisconsin, we can help set precedent and show the success stories to really, you know, make set an example for local labs. And it actually took 11 years of overcoming barriers and involving the community to construct this sanctuary and find a nice, peaceful location. And so fast forward all that time, we're located in Marquette County, just outside of Westfield, Wisconsin, on 17 acres, the monkey sanctuary is. And we had to let the press know about us. That's one big way, and very helpful there. And so an awesome donor, Chuck, he actually purchased the neighboring house because he saw such a need to help the monkeys. And so now today, it's a house for interns where they donate their labor in exchange for free rent. And then we have a program for volunteers at various tasks, and provide free education about primate behavior and primate care to those like me who had aspirations of learning about primates, but who don't necessarily, you know, want to work in a laboratory to learn about monkey behavior. And so we provide that platform. And now today, we are home to 9 monkeys, and 5 are retired from the pet trade and 4 from laboratories. So we're proud to say that we've helped this many so far, and providing space and dignity to these monkeys requires so much, you know, professional staff and volunteer hours and care and funding and effort. that it's really been great to see the community come together and have such wonderful staff. And then over the next 15 to 20 years, we'd like to help up to 100 monkeys. But since thousands need help in both the pet industry and laboratories, you know, we want to also provide the free education and serve as an example to inspire others. So, you know, I appreciate this platform today. So,
yeah, it's so important, Amy, to point out that you and other reputable sanctuaries not only meet the immediate needs of the monkeys in your care, but that you work to make the world better for the ones that aren't yet in your care and maybe never will be fortunate enough to be at your sanctuary. But you're using, like you said, you're using this radio program and your position as a platform to improve primate welfare and improve the way that these animals are treated in the various industries in which they're used. So, you know, I think sanctuaries are one of the only industries that try to put themselves out of business, right? That's the goal. Maybe one day they won't be needed. And it's so important for you to keep that bigger picture in mind, because I know caring for monkeys that are rescued is a, that can take up every hour of your day, but yet you are still dedicated towards doing more. And that's really commendable. I also would love to point out that, you know, Amy mentioned the opportunities to volunteer and intern at her facility. And even if you don't live near Primates Incorporated, but maybe you live near another sanctuary in another part of the country, that could be an option for anyone wishing to get involved here. So you can always check out NAPSA's website, which is primatesanctuaries.org. And look at, we have a spot there for job and volunteer and intern postings. And you can learn about how to get involved at Primates Inc. or other sanctuaries that might be closer to you.
All right, that is the end of clip number one. And we've got some great news. All right, why don't you go first, Emmett?
Well, we have a pledge from Cindy in Sun Prairie. And Cindy is an Evergreen donor, and she has increased her monthly donation, and she has gone with the sweatshirt. So thank you very much, Cindy in Sun Prairie.
Nice. And then we have Don, who also, oh no, Don went with the WORT binoculars, and his favorite shows are The Access Hour, The Insurgent Radio Kiosk, and The Vinyl Resting Place. Don also wanted us to read a comment on the air. He said, this donation is in honor of Ken Rainier and all the great work he has done for the Access Hour over the years. And that is the same Ken who is out there answering phones tonight. That number to call is 608-256-2001, extension 1. Or you can donate online at WORTFM.org, just like our next two donors. We have a donation from, oh, wow, actually, quite a few here. We have one from Sue, who is from Cupertino, and her comment is she's donating only because we love Adrian. Thank you so much, Sue. And we have another donation online from Oak Park, which is in Illinois, and this is from Phoebe, and Phoebe wants to say that Adrian Ranney rocks the Access Hour. Well, if that doesn't tell you I hit up some family members to donate tonight, I don't know what will. They are both new donors, and you can be a new donor too if you call in. Again, that number is 608-256-2001, extension 1. And what are some other thank you gifts that they can get, Emmett?
Well, at the $100 level, we have, actually, this one's only available online. So if you want the weekend duffel, you need to go online and order that. But otherwise, we've got the Progressive Magazine one-year subscription at the $40 level, the wart embroidered patch for at the $35 level, which is the art courtesy of our very own Adrian Ranney.
Oh yes, I do have fun designing things. And so I want to bring it back again to what would you listen to if WORT went off the air? I mean, I certainly wouldn't go back to listening to commercial radio. I have been just completely, I don't know, mesmerized by WORT. And if it wasn't for WORT, I probably would just listen to maybe Pandora. But I'm even bored of Pandora because I know what I'm going to get. I know if I turn on WORT, I have no idea what's going to come up next. Oh, and I've just been handed another pledge. This is from Lori and Doug. They are getting the WORT knit hat, and that is very nice. You two are going to love that. And their favorite shows are The Morning Buzz on Monday, The Access Hour, and the WORT Evening News. And you can be a donor and have your comments read over the air if you keep it tame. If you call in to 608-256-2001 extension 1 or go online and donate at wortfm.org. And now let's move on to our next clip. And this originally aired February 29th of 2016. And I chose this clip because it demonstrates how the Access Hour has brought local resources to the WORT listeners throughout the years. So, Domestic Abuse and Intervention Services, or DAIS, has been working with Sheltering Animals of Abuse Victims, also known as SAVE, to house the animals of domestic abuse victims as they seek help. If this sounds like a service that you think someone you know should have access to, or if you would like help donating or volunteering, please listen to the following clip. This program was hosted by Megan Centauri, Meg Shones, and Sherry Carr.
Welcome back. And we are talking about the SAVE program, S-A-A-V, Sheltering Animals of Abuse Victims, which is a program that houses animals of abuse victims. And it's a program that is a collaboration between the Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, Dane County Humane Society, and the SAVE program. And we're talking about the link between domestic abuse and animal abuse and how animals are used as a target by the abusers in a lot of situations. And as a humane officer, I remember going to conferences around the same time that Megan was becoming interested in starting up this program. And more our animal cruelty seminars and conferences were starting to talk about this link between domestic abuse. And we started having conferences with social workers as well as humane officers. And we were learning about how each other did their jobs and what we could do to collaborate and bring this together. And right around that time is when I met Megan, and she wanted to really get this SAVE program off the ground. So, Megan, how common is it for abusers to abuse pets?
It's actually far more common than I think most people would think or know. There is some current research that shows that up to 71% of victims that are coming into shelters report incidents of animal cruelty or threats of animal cruelty in the households. There is one study, and it's a bit dated right now, but it's from Wisconsin, and it's a survey of 72 victims that were seeking refuge in domestic abuse shelters in Wisconsin. And that survey found that 86% of those victims had pets, and in 80% of those cases, the batterer had abused the pets. So it's way more common than what people know. And we have a foster parent who talked about this and how she found out when she found out about this relationship, and she kind of describes it as one of those forehead slapping moments. And I always think that's so memorable because it's kind of like the duh, of course they go together once you hear about it. But until you've heard about it, it's probably never crossed your mind. So I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there having that experience now.
Right. And so now, so the part of the SAVE program includes getting the animals to the DAIS shelter. So, Meg, do you want to talk about how that works over at the DAIS shelter?
Sure. So, you know, when we were planning for this new building, you know, we looked at the different needs of the community, and something that was really prevalent is the need for victims to be able to leave right away. And oftentimes we saw that victims had to make that choice. Like, there's an open bed, so I can leave and get into the shelter, but I have to leave my pet behind. So we took that information and we created a temporary just emergency kennel within our shelter. So if victims are able to get into our shelter right away, they can bring their animal and then work with an advocate the next day to hear more about the SAVE program and get their animal into the SAVE program.
So from what I understand, it's like the first 48 hours is the most dangerous time when a victim leaves an abuser. So this allows them to take their animal with them at that critical time, correct?
That is correct, because we do know that an individual is up to 7 times more likely to be killed when they are leaving. So those first 48 hours are really critical.
It's also, just for listeners to know, it's really important that not only is it getting the victim out with her pet as a really important piece of it, but making sure that the victim doesn't go back into harm's way. Mm-hmm. And that's what was so striking to me about the first time I heard about this, is that somebody who had found safety for themselves put themselves directly into harm's way to save an animal. So it's also part of getting them out and making sure the pets are there too, so nobody ever has to try to go back to get the pets into safety. So it's really critical that DAYS has this emergency kennel on site.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great, because I would imagine then that would mean people would be bringing their children and other loved ones, as well as the pets, you know, back into that mm-hmm. situation if they couldn't get everybody out, including the pets.
That is correct. I mean, we know that for us animal lovers, our pets are our children, so you wouldn't leave one of your children behind.
So, Megan, do you want to talk some more about why abusers target animals?
Yeah. Meg really hit on it earlier in her comments when she talked about domestic violence being about power and control. And for a lot of abusers, targeting someone that their victim loves is a very effective way to control that human being. So what we see is abusers targeting animals as a way to keep the victim from leaving, as a way to kind of instill silence in the family, you know. As symbolic, you know, they're showing the victim, hey, I can do this to your beloved pet. Think of what I could do with you. And frankly, it's usually easier to get away with animal cruelty, just given the way the system is set up. And batterers know that. You don't often have mandatory reporting and, you know, things like that that you would have if someone were to target a child. And it is just a really an important and devastating way to control not just the victim, but children that are in the household also. If you think about the relationship that children have with their pets, batterers are using the pets not only over just the human, the people think of the adult on the other side of that. It is often the entire family that mm-hmm. is being controlled through this means.
So I would imagine then the children would also be perpetuating that by acting out against the pets and causing, you know, perpetuating some animal cruelty to the pets because that's what they're witnessing in the house.
Yeah.
So this can also help to break that cycle.
Absolutely. They call it the abuse reactive cycle. And it's something that people would also, you know, there's so many levels of this that I keep saying, you wouldn't know this, mm-hmm. But children model behavior. And so if you have animal abuse going on in the household, there is research showing that some children will model that behavior and then they will act out animal abuse as well. So part of getting the people into safety and the animals into safety is to stop this cycle of abuse so that we also don't have children perpetuating the abuse in the household.
So let's talk a little bit more about the SAVE program and how it works, but I want to give the email address to the listeners in case they wanted to email in questions, and that is info@saveprogram.org, info@saavprogram.org, and if you want to email, we can answer some questions that way. So talk to us about the SAVE program and how it got started and how it works.
Sure. So SAVE is a shelter program that provides temporary, confidential, emergency shelter for the animals of abuse victims for a period of up to 90 days. And really how it exists is SAVE is its own nonprofit organization. We were co-founded in May of 2001. At that time, we had a different name that we had come up with in law school. It was WOOF, Wisconsin United for Furry Friends. But that was before we had honed in on this particular part of the mission, and the name didn't really fit once we honed in on the serious nature of what we were doing. So we're our own all-volunteer nonprofit, and we provide the services through collaborating with DAYS, Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, who are the experts on the human side of domestic abuse, and then the Dane County Humane Society, who are the experts on the animal cruelty end of things. And we partnered that way, importantly, because we wanted to make sure, we kind of thought of the program as holistic, for lack of a better term. We wanted to make sure that the people who had expertise in dealing with humans going through trauma were provided the services they need, and likewise on the animal side. So I kind of think of the program as sort of like a triangle with SAVE sitting on the top and then coordinating the services between DAYS and the Humane Society. And we've been doing this work for 15 years, and I cannot tell you what a tremendous partnership it has been with both of these organizations. They are both experts at what they do. Those of you who are listening, support those organizations in addition to SAVE. They do such a wonderful job in the community. And so what we do is we provide our shelter through foster homes, confidential foster homes out in the community. So when we get an animal that needs shelter, we place the animal into a confidential foster home for a maximum period of 90 days. And during that time period, and you know, even thereafter, the person who is fostering that animal never has any idea whose animal that is. And likewise, the person who's using the program has no idea who's fostering their animal. So that information is kept very confidential for safety reasons primarily. And also because we, you know that people who are taking animals in their home don't necessarily want the full background and everything that's involved in that. We wanted to protect the confidentiality of the victims we're serving by not having them have to, you know, spill their private information and their names and all of the details with someone fostering.
So what kind of training would a foster family need to have in order to foster a SAVE animal?
A really good question. Our fosterers are approved by both the Humane Society and SAVE. They go through two specific orientations. They go through the standard orientation that the Humane Society offers to foster parents. And then they also do a special orientation with us, where we have a representative from DAYS there, myself doing the SAVE part of the training, and then someone from the Humane Society as well, so that everybody who works with us in our program gets kind of, we think of it as a domestic violence 101, background in domestic violence, background in the link with animal cruelty, and the unique parts of the program and the shelter experience, the foster experience that exist because of the nature of what we're doing. And we wanted it done that way for two reasons. Number one, and Meg, you can probably attest to this better, but if you're a victim and you're using our program, you are turning your animal over to a complete stranger, which is a huge leap of trust. And I've heard from Meg and others at DAYS that it is incredibly meaningful to victims to know that the person who has their animal understands even just a tiny little piece of what that victim has gone through. So that's, Meg, if you could talk about that just a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we know that, you know, as I talked a little bit earlier, domestic violence really is complex and it's hard to understand. And it's hard for friends and family members to understand that. And there's a lot of, with that question, why does a victim stay? There's a lot of blame on victims. And while friends and family, I think, always have the best intentions, sometimes victims aren't always hearing supportive statements from them. So it's really important to them to know that the person that's going to get their animal understands domestic violence, understands those complexities, understands the barriers to leaving, and just understands that this animal is like a child to them. This is very important to them. And we've just heard that they've been very comforted by that. And I think there's also just a comfort with knowing that a DAYS representative has met all of the fosters. We may not know who has their animal, but we've met all of them. We've talked with them. So that's really, really important to them.
The second reason that we do the training in addition to what Meg said is we just thought it was important for people working with our program to also kind of be able to go out into the community and be ambassadors on this issue, and to understand why we're doing what we're doing. Because while we're helping individual people find safety, and that's our number one goal for themselves and for their animals, we are also trying, our broader mission is to try to stop the cycle of abuse. And so we wanted people working with our program to understand how it fits into the wider context.
And from the animal end of it, they also, the foster people, need to understand the aspect that it might take a victim several times to leave the situation finally and in the end. So that foster family would need to understand that that animal might be going back into the situation and then back out, and that sort of thing. So that's another piece of it that the victim needs that support, you know, while they, you know, continue to go in and out of the situation so that they can make a final break in the end.
Absolutely.
So if there's an abuse victim who's listening right now who would like to use the program, who should that person contact?
So for victims wishing to use the program, let me talk about how someone who's eligible to use the program. So the SAVE program serves victims in Dane County who are receiving services from DAYS at the time of intake into our program. So that does not mean that they have to be staying in the shelter. They can be receiving a crisis support network, any of the various services that DAYS provides. So their into the program is through DAYS. And they would call the DAYS helpline, which is 608-255-4445 or 1-800-747-4045. And all intake for the program for victims goes through DAYS, and that's how the victim side of it works. For folks who are interested in learning more about SAVE, the work we do, volunteering, you can go to our website, saveprogram.org, all one word, or send us an email, info@saveprogram.org. But inquiries, general inquiries about SAVE should not go to DAYS. That you can send our direction, but victims looking for services should definitely do the intake through DAYS.
So if someone wanted to volunteer for the SAVE program, what sorts of outreach things or what sorts of things happen that they could volunteer for?
Sure. Our biggest need is for foster families. We try to keep a robust foster list for a couple reasons. One, we don't want to overburden the people who are kind enough to take an animal into their home for 90 days. So we like to have lots of available options. The second thing is we get animals in that have, you know, different limitations. So we might have a really great, cute puppy, but the puppy can't be with a cat. So we might have, you know, 40 available foster homes, but only 10 of them don't have cats. So we have lots of different needs. We also provide shelter for all kinds of animals. People think of dogs and cats, but we've done bunnies and iguanas and birds and snakes and, you know, any kind of animal. So if you are an expert in bunnies and you're waiting for an opportunity to foster a bunny, we someday may have a need for someone with expertise in that area. So we try to keep a robust list. So fostering is our number one need.
And we have a donor. We have a donation from a Mortimer McGillicuddy. And Mortimer is doing a one-time gift, and they would like the Madison Illustrated History. And Mortimer's favorite shows are The Access Hour, Who Cooks for You, and Rocking John. So thank you so much, Mortimer.
Thank you, Mortimer. And we also have some online donations that we need to thank. First is Evan from Madison. His three favorite shows are Mosh Pit, Pan Africa, and Who Cooks for You. Evan also left a comment that WORT is such an important part of the community. I appreciate all the volunteers, especially the engineers. P.S. Pop radio is trash. And I agree, Evan, and he will be taking home another Weirdo for Wart hoodie sweatshirt. Next, we have Dave from Cupertino. And Dave left a comment saying, would it kill you to play some Fog Hat? Well, Dave, to that I say, you should sign up for an access hour and play all the Fog Hat you want. And we have one more online donation to thank. This is from Anonymous, who left a comment saying, what a great program. Glad to see Dane County Humane Society and DAYS are partnering with SAVE. And, oh, looks like we have, oh, no, we do not. Just somebody passing through. So that number to call is 608-256-2001, extension 1, or go online to donate at wortfm.org. And Emmett, why should they donate?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about inflation. If you go to a grocery store to get five pounds of sugar, you're only going to get 4 pounds. So even if they keep the price the same, you're getting less. And we're just not going to let that happen at WORT. when you make a donation, we're going to make sure you get 100% of that donation. So we're doing our part to fight inflation, and I don't think our rates have gone up in the last couple of years for donations, have they?
I don't think so. Over the time that I've been here and from what I've heard from staff members before me, donations have remained the same. So that's pretty amazing. Next, we're going to get to a clip that was originally aired 8 years ago on March 21st, 2016. So this was hosted by Megan Harris of Green Madison, who coordinated the discussion about homeowner energy savings programs and its affiliates, including Project Home, Elevate Energy, Cool Choices, and Focus on Energy. The following clip focuses on the Energy 2030 initiative that was just taking shape when this aired. Brian Driscoll from MGME discusses the goals of Energy 2030 and the markers that they hope to hit by just 2025, which is only a year from now. So let's listen and see if we are on track to make those green energy goals.
And speaking of resources, coming up after this quick music break, we will be talking with representatives from MGE and Focus on Energy about the various programs they offer to help residents improve their living conditions. Welcome back. Up next here at the station, we have Brian Driscoll from MGE. Brian is the Multifamily Services Manager for MGE. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you for being here with us tonight. MGE has been a great supporter of the Green Madison Initiative since we rolled out the program in 2015. Thank you so much for your support.
Absolutely.
How do the Green Madison efforts and MGE efforts fit together?
That's a great question. Green Madison's effort since 2015 has been focused on many different aspects: government facilities, residential single family, multifamily. We're going to get to hear more about the Cool Choices business outreach in a little while. And all of these efforts fit into an overall framework of what MGE has been trying to do for many, many years. Right now, we're focused on something called Energy 2030, and this is really an effort to do something that we're calling building a community energy company for the future. So what we've done is try to take all the great ideas from the past and continue them forward, but then also try to incorporate some new ideas. And what I can say is that this Energy 2030 framework has been put together through some really conscious efforts. And in 2015, we were able to put together something called Community Energy Conversations. So we had small group discussions take place with over 650 individuals. We put out customer surveys. We did industry research. We also have many collaborative partnerships, including the folks in this room, and then just more and more stakeholder discussions and then some company planning and analysis. So what I can say is that what Green Madison is doing with you and I working together on multifamily, or what Focus on Energy is doing with multifamily, or what the Home Performance Program does through Focus on Energy, all of these things support the opportunity for a clean energy future.
Great. So what are some of the objectives of Energy 2030?
That's a good question. What we're really hoping to accomplish first and foremost with the name Energy 2030 is supplying 30% of our energy sales through renewable resources by 2030. And really, as a milestone goal, we're going to be shooting for 25% by 2025. And this matches up really nicely with what a lot of our local governments have been doing. The city of Madison, the city of Middleton, the city of Monona, the city of Fitchburg, and even Dane County, all of them have passed local resolutions saying it's important to their residents to have 25% renewable energy by 2025. So we're respecting those goals, trying to incorporate those goals, and even shoot a little bit further. The other things that we're really hoping to do as a byproduct, I guess you could say, is continue to reduce the carbon dioxide emissions. And we're shooting for about 40% reduction by 2030 compared to 2005 levels. And obviously, we've been talking about energy efficiency, conservation, and even renewables. What we're trying to do is to increase that engagement in the future. And understanding how we increase all that, we also have to balance the idea around a more dynamic and integrated electric grid system that's going to support a lot of these new technologies in the future. What we also hope to do, maybe with some pilots and some other things happening in the near future, is develop and test new products and services that we can offer our customers. Some really good examples are a recent development around community solar. We've had electric vehicle charging stations for a while, and we're even looking at smart thermostats right now. And we just want to continue to deepen the engagement with our customers because they're the ones that have been telling us for years now what they want to see for their clean energy future.
Have you guys done anything like this in the past?
That's another good question. And what I guess I would say is that we're trying to take some of the same learning lessons that we did for Energy 2015 for Energy 2030. So starting back in 2005, we began a process that looked similar to the process that we are currently in. But this time around, what we've tried to do is engage the public even more broadly. The first time around from 2005 to 2015, we mostly did customer surveys, and we had one large in-person meeting. And what we've tried to do now in learning from the good things that took place for Energy 2015 is that we wanted to engage a more diverse and broader audience. And we're understanding the demographic changes of Dane County and the city of Madison. And we made conscious efforts to reach out to communities of color. And what we did with that is make sure that we had third-party facilitated conversations so that folks would have the ability to have their voices heard and have them come from multiple perspectives. So what we're really trying to do is represent the broad and diverse cultures of the city of Madison and the surrounding area.
Gotcha. Excuse me. I have something in my throat here. So do you consider the framework ambitious? Could you have done it, or could you plan it to go further and go faster?
Well, we've gotten that question before, and I guess what I would say is a straightforward answer to being ambitious. We would say yes, that the Energy 2030 framework is ambitious, because we're doing this goal setting despite projections of significant population increases within our service territory from now into 2030. And as far as MG&E is aware, no other utility is proposing a framework similar to MG&E's here in the state of Wisconsin. So when you compare MG&E to other investor-owned utilities throughout the state of Wisconsin, we're kind of setting a high bar. And I guess what we're really hoping to do is to continue to push ourselves. And when someone says, can you go further, can you go faster, if we find that we can go further and we can go faster, we will do that. It will depend upon how quickly and successfully we achieve the goals we've set out in front of us. And it really depends upon, and I'm glad we're a part of this program, it depends upon customer participation. We need homeowners, we need business owners to really engage us so that there is more conservation, there is more energy efficiency, and some of those early adopters take the opportunity to look at renewables. Renewables are going to be a major component of our generation into the future.
Great. And if listeners are interested in more information on Energy 2030 or anything else we've discussed tonight, where can they find that information?
The best place to go for all sorts of information around Energy 2030 is to go to mge.com/community. Dash conversation. So that's mge.com/community conversations. And I'll make sure to give my personal contact information when we're all done.
That would be great. I know that I did one of your community energy conversations at the end of 2015, and I was really impressed with the range of interest and different stakeholders brought to the conversation. So you must have gotten a lot of good input out of that.
Excellent input, and that's the best way to get your information.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely.
All right, and after that just flurry of donations and pledges, we don't have any on this break. So that number to call is 608-256-2001, extension 1. If you're kind of on the fence about it, now would be the time to call, because we are heading into our last clip of the evening And, you also have the option of donating online at WORTFM.org. There's a big orange banner at the top of the homepage. Just click on that to donate. So our final clip this evening I chose because it shows how educational the Access Hour can be. With spring just around the corner, we are on track for the yearly discussion of No Mow May, a movement that has gained traction as a way to conserve the local bee population. I think we can all agree that bees are a vital part of our fragile ecosystem, and Dane County's horticulture educator and local horticulture educator, having trouble reading this that I wrote, but local beekeeper Tim Ripp hosted the Access Hour on June 19th, 2023 to speak about Pollinator Week, and he got into some serious bee talk.
You know, when we think about pollinators, again, we do tend to think a lot about bees, and we do have a publication at the UW Learning Store called the Wisconsin Bee ID Guide that Tim's going to tell you about in just a moment. But there are also so many other pollinators. One thing that in doing my usual reading that I came up or that I came up against, not up against, but I found was a study that had been done in this journal that I mentioned earlier, the Journal of Economic Entomology, that was talking about moths. And, you know, a lot of times people look at a moth and it's kind of drab looking and you don't see it very much because it's nocturnal. But apparently, they can do as much pollinating in an apple orchard as the honeybee that is out during the day. And I thought that was really interesting because a lot of times, you know, people will see a caterpillar chewing on their plant and it might end up being something that is a good guy as an adult. The other thing that I wanted to mention about butterflies as well as moths, if you want to encourage them in your yard, is that you need to think about having food sources for both the larva, that's the caterpillar, as well as the adult, the butterfly or moth. The butterfly or moth is going to need nectar sources, so plants that have a lot of nectar, and the larva may need something completely different to feed itself. And usually, you know, the parent is going to know what plant they need to lay that egg on. We don't always know that. So we do also have some resources on some good butterfly plants that will work for both the larva and the adult. So, Tim, do you want to talk briefly about the Wisconsin BID guide so that people can know what they're looking at?
Sure. Absolutely, Lisa. I think it's a wonderful point to bring this up. I think when people think of pollinators, they often do think honeybees, right? That's sort of the age-old thing. But Wisconsin has over, I think, close to 500 native bees. Yep. And 70% actually of our native bees do not live in a colony and do not live in a hive. They're ground-dwelling bees. And this Wisconsin Bee Identification Guide is a wonderful resource to many of our native bees in Wisconsin. It can be found if you just really Google Wisconsin Bee Identification Guide, it's there. Or you can also find it through our Hort Extension website at hort.extension.wisc.edu. You know, the honeybee, again, gets all the fame, but they're early season apples are often pollinated by some of our early bees, like mason bees and even sweat bees, and a lot of the smaller bees. It's pretty amazing. I am personally a beekeeper. I do keep European honeybees, and I love them, but they don't do the heavy lifting in our state. A lot of our native bees do, and so this guide is just a wonderful resource. You can really delve into all the different kinds of bees in the state, where they live, what types of habitat they prefer, and how you can support them.
That's great. And another bee resource is the Bumblebee Brigade, which is an initiative of the Wisconsin DNR, and they are also encouraging people to take pictures of bees and report what they're seeing so that they can monitor the different population levels. And there are, I think, about 20 that they're particularly interested in. One of my favorite.
List.
Yeah.
Top of the list is
the rusty-patched bumblebee, which is an endangered species. And that's one that is definitely a good idea to keep your eyes out for, because we really want to know how they're doing and how we can assist them. You mentioned the sweat bee, Tim. That's one of the ones that I like. I like the little solitary bees that, you know, do their thing, and they're usually in hollow stems. They might be hanging out in cavities. They're often in a little single burrow in the ground, and you would never even know that they're there. But one of my favorite bees is the leafcutter bee. And this is one that sometimes causes consternation for gardeners, because they'll go out in the garden and they'll see that there are all these little round holes cut out of leaves, usually around the margin. And that's the leafcutter bee harvesting that material to line her nest. Usually there aren't, you know, that big of an attack that you need to worry about on your plants. It's more of a curiosity. And I think that that's a really cool little bee.
Yeah, I think they're great. It really is amazing. The more I learn about bees through this Pollinator Week and as a beekeeper, I think it's amazing that you have bees like the bumblebee also that, you know, overwinters as a single queen in a nest in the ground and then creates a whole colony from one single queen in the springtime. And so these really early bees, they might come out in, you know, early April, May, and June, and then you might not see them for the rest of the season. So they're pretty amazing. And as far as the rusty patch goes, I'm going to touch on that for one more second. Mm-hmm. We should find ourselves very lucky that we still have some left in our area. And so, yes, with iNaturalist or the Bumblebee Brigade or the WeeBee app, if you can monitor those at all, that it's going to help our science tremendously. So
we've kind of been talking around plants and talking that we need different kinds of plants for pollinators. So I'd like to spend just a couple of seconds talking about different pollinator plants. You know, we could have spent a whole week talking about the different kinds of plants that will support pollinators. But if you're trying to plant a pollinator garden or just have a regular garden that has some plants in it that will support pollinators, the really important thing to think about is having something blooming at all parts of the growing season. So very early in the spring to the summer, to the late summer, to fall. It's really important to provide that food source for them during that whole time. So I started out tonight thinking I would talk about, you know, five plants, and then that kind of grew to 10 plants. And yeah, okay, so now I have a list of 12. And these are not necessarily the be all and end all of pollinator plants. They're ones that I happen to like that I think are very good for pollinators. And some of them are woody plants. And the first one on my list is a shrub. It is the vernal witch hazel, which is not our native witch hazel. That's a very cool plant, too, and it blooms very late in the fall, so there might still be some pollinators active at the time that it blooms, but usually it's a little later than most pollinators are around. But the vernal or spring witch hazel is a U.S. native a little farther south, but it blooms in March. And when I see it blooming, it's always surrounded by usually small species of bees, but I often will see a honeybee thrown in there as well. And another early season plant that I really like for pollinators is our native bloodroot. And that is a beautiful little shade plant that would be in the woodlands. Blooms very early. It comes up with the leaf curled around the stem. And the plant will flower and set seed. And then the leaf will uncurl into this wonderful kind of rounded...
All right, and I just want to make a quick note before we go off the air here that that was Lisa Johnson, who is Dane County's horticulture educator, who was presenting that clip with Tim Ripp, who is a local beekeeper. And if you've enjoyed the clips you've heard this evening, you can find the entire shows on the WORT website. And if you have something that you would like to discuss on the Access Hour, you can sign up at WORTFM.org. I just want to say thank you to all the Access Hour hosts, and thank you to all the listeners who keep WORT on the air. We love you. We appreciate you. And now, stay tuned for something wonderful.
Take my hand, jump on my back, 'cause I'm the man. Pass me a black napkin, please. Dropped out of college, don't have a degree, and I can't get a date. It's not my fault, I'm not bringing home the juice, I'm not bringing home the bacon. It's good enough for Nancy. Good enough for Nancy. So what if I like the big truck?